This week's Security Ledger podcast is brought to you by Looking Glass Cyber Solutions. Looking Glass gives you unrivaled visibility into the threat landscape. If you're at the RSA conference this week, stop by to check out Looking Glass at their booth, number 100 in the South Hall at Moscone Center. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's podcast, episode number 92, the RSA Security Conference is kicking off in San Francisco. Attendees here are going to be hearing a lot about cyber threat intelligence services, but what are they and how can they separate the threat intel wheat from the chaff? In our second segment this week, we'll sit down with the folks from Looking Glass to answer some of those questions. But first, what do companies like chip testing firm Xcera, in-flight Wi-Fi provider Global Eagle, and the money transfer firm MoneyGram have in common? They've all had acquisitions by willing foreign buyers blocked by the U.S. government in recent months. The Chertoff Group has highlighted the increased risk posed by third-party software and supply chain partners as a trend to watch in 2018. In our first segment this week, we speak with Adam Isles about the heightened scrutiny that the U.S. government is giving to foreign acquisitions of technology companies of all different stripes. To start off, I asked Adam to talk about another of the Chertoff Group's predictions for 2018, increased threats and attacks aimed at Internet of Things devices.
Adam Isles, and I'm a principal at the Chertoff Group. What you have, you know, across the globe is a series of technologies that have historically been standalone technologies that are now becoming IP aware. And as they become IP aware, they're doing so without necessarily security having been designed into the product. And so that creates an exposure. It creates a risk around the extent to which the integrity, the availability, the confidentiality of data that's associated with those devices could somehow be exposed. I think the second issue is, from the point of view of resiliency, even if we in the United States were, you know, to come up with an approach for how to do so, the internet is borderless, right? And so many of the devices that were used in the attack that I referred to lay outside the United States. And so what you then have is, I think, a kind of a second order business continuity issue around, look, if we've got, you know, critical dependencies on a certain, you know, provider, do we have redundancy in place? And so really what you're talking about is kind of an entire, I'd say, kind of a risk management wide approach to addressing the risk around IoT that involves not just the producers of these devices, but also the consumers of them.
So somewhat related to that, in your list of, you know, six trends to watch in 2018 are, you know, disruptive or increasingly disruptive, destructive attacks targeting industrial control systems. Is this something that is already happening, but maybe underreported? I think we're getting to the point now where when these stories come up, at least in my head as a reporter, I'm thinking, is this retaliatory? You know, is this story somehow linked to, you know, tension between Russia and the United States, or tension in the South China Sea, or tension in the Middle East related to Iran? You know, are these incidents linked? And I'm not sure that 2 or 3 years ago, I would be thinking things like that.
Well, I think you've got a couple of trends going on. One is I think you are seeing a trend around disruptive attacks, and disruptive attacks being used as basically a tool of statecraft. And I would say that that trend is not confined to industrial control systems. Industrial control systems are certainly a target, but the attacks are not limited to those. I think of one of the most alarming attacks was the NotPetya ransomware attack that occurred last June. And it was concerning not just because of the damage that it did. You know, you had major American companies victimized by that attack, you know, to the tune of $400, $500, $600 million of revenue and expense impacts to them, but also because of the way that it was orchestrated, right? I mean, that ransomware attack, basically the intrusion vector was a piece of tax software. You know, that if you did business in Ukraine And, you know, you needed tax software to file your taxes in Ukraine and maybe manage your payroll as well. You were using that software. And so the auto update process in that was compromised as a way of inserting the kind of the exploit into victim organizations. And so what you're getting at there, right, is not just the consequence, but also from the point of view of threat, changing motivations of threat actors, and from the point of view of vulnerability, the exploitation of the supply chain as an intrusion vector into organizations.
Yeah. It's kind of a package deal, kind of all the bad stuff just thrown into one incident.
Oh, and by the way, you know, leveraging, allegedly leaked NSA tools to do
Yep, that too. That was in there too. Yeah.
When we've looked at cyber intrusions over the course of the last 5 years, they've been mostly conversations from the point of view of impact to an organization around impacts to the expense side of the income statement, right? You've got remediation costs. You've got, legal fees that you're focused on. What we're seeing here is an operational impact, an impact to revenue, right? I mean, Merck couldn't ship product. FedEx couldn't, move packages. Maersk, couldn't move.
Didn't know where their containers were. Yeah, right. They're tracking, cargo containers with, pen and paper. I mean, one of the, I guess, byproducts of this increasing confluence of online activity and cyber offensive activity by Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. I think we are starting to see in the commercial realm, which is that the U.S. government, by way of the CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., has basically kneecapped a whole bunch of deals, particularly with Chinese acquirers of U.S. companies. I note Xterra, Lattice Semiconductor, Global Eagle, which does like in-flight Wi-Fi, MoneyGram, and there are more, basically on national security grounds. There's now talk about expanding that to fintech, financial technologies. What do you make of this? And what is this presage for the years ahead in terms of, foreign acquisition of U.S. firms, U.S. acquisition of foreign firms, and just kind of the role that government's going to play in kind of refereeing these types of business deals that up till now have been pretty much government's been hands off with all of them, except maybe around, defense, clearly, military technologies.
Yeah, I think you have to think about it in the context of risk and how risk is changing. And so how do we define risk, right? We think of risk as a function of threat, vulnerability, and consequence. And so when you think about, for instance, consequence and impact to national security, there are themes that have been out there for a long time. I mean, I started my career at the U.S. Justice Department, and I was involved in the CFIUS process, 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, we were worried about protecting law enforcement, intelligence community equities in the context of foreign takeovers. The idea that somehow a backdoor could be introduced or that we'd lose access to data. In the same context, defense technology has been a kind of a historic focus. I think as we think about how CFIUS has evolved, you do see an increasing focus around PII, personally identifiable information, and whether you could somehow through a kind of a mosaic approach, paint a picture of the U.S. population by having access to data. But beyond that, I think I'd probably focus on the way the vulnerabilities have changed. I mean, think about the conversation we were just having around NotPetya and the exploitation of a vulnerability. Well, technology has become much more complex, right? I mean, so, if the F-22, fighter jet had several million lines of code in it. Ford Motor Company is advertising that the Ford F-150 has 150 million lines of code in it. And, we have hundreds of millions of open source software libraries available now. If you're thinking about a kind of a modern DevOps environment, software can change 100 times a day. And we talked about IoT earlier, and so you've got more complexity in technology. I think you've got increasingly also technology that's being looked at in a kind of a dual use context. So as we think about artificial intelligence, virtual reality, facial recognition, right? I mean, you've got commercial application, but you've also got application that is important for next generation military superiority. So you've got, an evolving sense of what the vulnerabilities are. And then from the point of view of threat actors, we've got not only threat actors that kind of have a fairly consistent record of, working to achieve their own ends in ways. But in addition to that, you've got threat actors using increasingly disruptive tactics. So think of the NotPetya conversation we just had. So I think all of those things are, kind of evolving towards taking a much more skeptical view to mitigation, right? So in other words, if you think about CFIUS process, you've got fundamentally two questions. One is there a risk? And two, is it possible to mitigate those risks? And so I think what you're seeing is a much dimmer view around
mitigation.
Yeah.
And a much broader understanding of risk.
That's right.
It's funny when you start talking about sort of the supply chain piece or Huawei and, our smart. Well, I was having drinks with a guy from my hometown who's kind of a consultant, and he was showing off his Huawei smart fitness watch. And at the same time, kind of bemoaning or wondering, Jesus, this thing, tracking me and sending the data back to servers in China. The short answer to which, of course, is yes. It is possible to really get into the, they're tampering with our precious bodily fluids or the, black helicopter type thinking around some of this supply chain risk. On the other hand, you read stories, for example, about the DJI drones and concerns that data from those drones, that were deployed in agricultural settings were fed back and perhaps used to give Chinese buyers the edge in acquiring vineyards in Northern California and so on. And you start to think, well, maybe we're not being too paranoid here. Maybe they are messing with our precious bodily fluids. Where do you draw the line with that stuff? When are you getting too paranoid and too crazy? And I guess the bigger question is, the electronics industry has relied on the global supply chain, particularly China, for decades now. If you're a company that wants to make one of those products, how do you get a comfort level around that? Do we see maybe a push for the creation of a North American supply chain to offset that and bring more of this back in country?
I think this really becomes a facts and circumstances discussion. And what we need to really focus on is security effectiveness. What's more risky, right? A Chinese-owned company with, U.S. employees, a U.S. data center, and no Chinese technology, notwithstanding the ownership, or, a British company with data centers in China and Chinese employees. At a certain level, it gets impossible to take all the risk out of this. And so what you really start to think about is, the extent to which I've got, a truly risk-based strategy and oversight mechanism in place. I've got a layered defense in place that's thinking about how am I risk assessing the supply chain? How am I implementing preventive measures based on risk and designing for resiliency? And then what am I doing by way of testing and auditing to make sure that what I think I have in place is actually working? Because it's kind of like, what's the alternative? And I mean, you raised a point earlier that we haven't really covered yet, which is, but what are the economic repercussions of all this? I mean, at some point, someone needs to say, look, if we do this, we have to expect that the folks on the other end of this are going to do something similar. And so as we think about exports and economic impact, there's certainly an effort to look at some of the gaps in CFIUS right now. So there is a bipartisan effort in Congress to look at modernizing CFIUS to cover at least some of the risks that it doesn't right now. And I think that's an important development. I think what's going to be key there again is making sure that as those reforms are considered, we think about their practical implementability. In other words, if you expand it to kind of, you know, an additional set of investments, how would you actually manage the workload of that? And is there a way of doing so in a way that doesn't unintentionally sweep in a very broad swath of transactions that don't present a whole lot of risk?
It is a fascinating discussion. I mean, it strikes me that there's very little trust right now. I think, and certainly many of the events of the past 2 or 3 years have only undermined that. Maybe even going back to Stuxnet, you know, maybe going back that far. But there's less and less trust. I think more and more lack of faith in the ability of folks on the other side of any transaction or business deal to act accordingly.
Well, we need to get past that. I mean, we need to figure out a way of managing risk in a way that is not one size fits all. I think there is the opportunity to do that. I mean, at a certain point, you know, with a particular company, you may be so convinced that that company is basically a stand-in for an intelligence agency that you're not comfortable with dealing with that company. But that doesn't mean that you kind of condemn the entire industry necessarily in the same way. And I think as organizations build more security into their supply chains, take more nuanced views of, you know, how something will be applied and maintained. I mean, ultimately, we're looking for a security that's both effective and durable over time.
Adam Iles, principal at the Chertoff Group, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us at the Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
And next, as attendees gather at the RSA conference in San Francisco, they're being barraged with marketing pitches of all stripes. One of the most persistent is about the need for organizations to make use of cyber threat intelligence. That sounds good, but what does it mean exactly? And what are the different ways that threat intelligence can be absorbed and applied to real-world threats and attacks? Is there a hierarchy of threat intelligence? And if so, what is it? How does one tell useful threat intelligence from expensive digital noise? This week's podcast sponsor, Looking Glass, thinks that they can answer those questions. We sat down with two Looking Glass experts in the Security Ledger studio, James Carnall, who's the Vice President of Customer Support, and Eric Olson, who's the Senior Vice President of Products, to talk about the evolving threat intelligence space and how threat intelligence is best put to use in combating sophisticated attacks. And with RSA happening this week, Eric and James give us their thoughts on what's happening and what's hot at the show.
My name is Eric Olson. I am the SVP of Product Management.
My name is James Connell, and I'm in charge of customer support at Looking Glass.
Welcome, James and Eric, to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. I think probably the best place to start for our listeners who might not be familiar with Looking Glass is to talk just a little bit about what Looking Glass does and the Looking Glass platform.
We attack the problem of cybersecurity specifically through threat intelligence. That is our core mission. We are intelligence focused, but we are not a niche company. We don't make a platform or a piece of software. So just to frame our answer, Looking Glass actually operates in four distinct categories. And they are as follows. First, we provide data. This is what many people refer to or think they mean when they say cyber threat intelligence. Structured data, neat rows and columns in XML and JSON and things like that around technical threat indicators, your traditional IPs and URLs and domains and hashes and other machine-readable threat intelligence. But that is only one relatively small part of our business. Much larger are our software platforms, your threat intelligence management or TIP products, our services division, which provides human support, managed services round the clock, and finally, a mitigation line of business where we produce very specialized physical hardware devices that provide network defense and mitigation capabilities that are a little atypical from your garden variety UTM or firewall or something like that.
Again, thank you, Eric. And what brings people to the doorstep, having that we have that variety, is we have a nice combination of data and platforms and people. And what we find is we're very effective at building a great relationship, a trusted relationship with our clients, because they understand, we understand both pieces, right? The challenges of collection, detection, of normalizing the data, and then getting it in the hands of the people that need it so they can interpret it as human beings, so they can then take action. So that trusted relationship, that ability that we have both sides of the coin there, is why people keep coming back and seeing us at the booth.
So we're having this conversation, a little bit ahead of the RSA Security Conference out in San Francisco. Threat intelligence, broadly defined, obviously is a huge area of interest and investment now in the information security space. But I think people kind of talk about it like monolithically, like, oh, it's they do threat intelligence. And as you guys know well, there is a tremendous amount of variety within under that big umbrella of threat intelligence. How do you guys see the space, or what's your read on the space as it exists today? And, you know, for folks who might be on the floor at RSA or Googling furiously to investigate this category of products, what do they need to know?
It is not a monolithic industry at all. When we talk about threat intelligence, that can mean anything from bad IPs in a text file to finished intelligence product running purple prose at 35 pages from a bunch of multilingual high-end threat researchers and security technical or even geopolitical analysts. There are also software platforms, hardware platforms, data feeds, connectors that just allow all the kit in this industry to try and talk to each other because standards are still evolving. There are a lot of moving parts, so it is a very fragmented industry, or perhaps many of them under that general term. The second thing I would say is that it's very crowded, and a lot of the vendors are doing some cool things, but a lot of them are small. A lot of them are startups. Looking Glass is, again, the exception. Looking Glass itself as an entity is, I think, 12 years old, and at least one of its predecessor acquisitions, Cyvalence, from which James and I originate. I've been at this company just under 20 years myself. So there are very few old players in the space, so it's important to evaluate not just the quality of the data, but the quality of the vendor, the longevity, the financial stability, and so on. And the third thing I would say about the new person, the newly minted CISO Googling furiously, or whoever it is that as James and I have webinared many a time, in order for information or data to be intelligence, because data is not intelligence, that information in some form must be made relevant and actionable to the organization consuming it. Otherwise, it's just interesting bathroom reading. James?
I absolutely agree. I think that again, one of the things that's difficult and why it is overwhelming is there is this overwhelming need to collect everything without necessarily understanding what the value of it is. And that's not entirely clear because, again, some of the items out there can be sold for a multitude of different reasons. So, again, what makes us unique in this area is we focus on our clients' needs. We are looking for attacks against them by name. And if they do need additional data feeds, certainly we have that. If they want a bigger picture of all phishing attacks that we collect and all malware and C2, but certainly we're very focused on trying to reduce the noise and focus on specifically what they need to know to protect them. And I think some of it gets lost, right, in all the noise of marketing and product speak. It's difficult for them to interpret it.
And this happens all the time in security, right? That that technology becomes relevant or gets hot, and all of a sudden everybody's sort of pivoting to that. It's like everybody's rushing towards the same point. What I see too is loose nomenclature. Everybody now who has any aggregated attack or endpoint data is sort of branding it as threat intelligence, right? So we've been collecting data from our customers for 10 years. You know, we're a threat intelligence vendor because we've got all this historical data from our customers. And it's like, well, not exactly. That's not exactly what we're talking about. What I hear as a differentiator is kind of that the human piece of it, the analysts who are charged with helping to make sense of this or making it actionable. So you guys noted you got sort of this global network of threat analysts. Who are these people and what do they do? What's their role in the process?
To address your question, Paul, so again, we have a multitude of different backgrounds of the analysts that we recruit here at Looking Glass, right? We have cyber analysts trained formally through school growing up that way. We have retired military. We have foreign language linguists that we need, obviously, to cover certain areas of the world. A lot of intelligence studies graduates, big data. We have a lot of IT ops backgrounds within our team as well. Obviously, networking is important, phishing and malware analysis. So these are the sorts of backgrounds of the individuals that we recruit. And why we do that is the diversity of our clients' needs, right? So we, again, addressing anything from malware to phishing, brand protection, trademark, information protection, network security, physical security threats, geopolitical threats. So we do essentially a 24/7 operation center that we have that helps us sift through that data, obviously mitigate any phishing attacks we have or malware takedowns. If there's any social media activity that fake accounts, things like that, we can take action on that for our clients. But then beyond that, we also have the contextual intelligence where analysts can provide additional information on the incident that we found, whether it be a logical threat or a physical threat, potentially who the actor may be. And then, of course, we have an investigation level of analysts. So we have analysts that are available for bespoke investigations, and we have analysts at the research level, and they're the ones that are looking much more at the big trending information that we have. So we're collecting, obviously, all of this data and information that Eric's talked about. We're vetting a lot of it with our human analysts, and we're reporting a lot of it, things that are of high interest to our clients that are obviously very focused on them. And then, of course, there's the ability to pull trending information out. And you do need intelligence analysts to be able to sort through that and provide opinions. And that's why our clients see us at all those different levels, augmenting their needs, right, their capabilities.
You know, I think within the last year, we've seen cyber attacks that have kind of crossed the line from merely disruptive to organizations to actually destructive. And certainly we saw that with the, you know, NotPetya and the WannaCry attacks. You go back a little bit further to Sony Pictures Entertainment and incidents like that. You know, companies, organizations are really freaked out about this. They obviously want to get in front of these attacks, many of which are sort of lurking on their network for a long time before they're sprung. What role does threat intelligence play in for companies that are looking to protect themselves from those types of threats and incidents?
First, open source intelligence from the publicly accessible parts of the internet, that has a role to play in several areas. The first is an outside-in or external perspective assessment of the customer's or enterprise's posture and vulnerabilities. We perform attack service analyses. Customers may perform pen tests, vulnerability assessments, red teams, et cetera. All of these are variations on a theme, which is to use the externally available information. Another way that threat intelligence can assist in mitigating the risk of these types of attacks is by studying past activity, actors, landscape, tactics, and procedures against peer companies or similar networks so that your vulnerability scanner may say, hey, this website or that host has 100 vulnerabilities and 20 of them are marked critical. But which ones are actually being exploited right now by actors who target my industry or similar size companies or companies with my management team's politics? Because some of this nation state or ideological activity is motivated by that more than industry. Finally, a third example, there are many, many others, is your traditional, quote, threat intelligence, the structured data feed, machine readable IPs and hosts and blacklists and bad URLs and that sort of thing, the hashes and domains that can be fed into the network layer for block or allow decisions, or if you have kit like ours, there are some more interesting and more advanced things that you can do. But the point is that that intelligence will in some form feed into a gateway, a UTM, a firewall, some device that allows you to act on it at the ones and zeros level.
We're talking, obviously, ahead of the RSA conference in San Francisco. Two questions, I guess. First of all, what's Looking Glass up to at RSA? And second, I'd be interested in your thoughts on sort of what you think is new, different, noteworthy this year at the conference.
So, you know, again, as Eric sort of touched on, the threat intelligence services, the Scout Shield, the Scout Prime, third-party risk management, we'll be doing lots of demos. Obviously, we've got a big team there. We'd certainly love to have as many people come through and understand a little bit about our services and our business. 100 South Hall is our location. So we certainly invite you to come along and check us out.
One of the things that we are talking a lot about right now in the industry is communication and standards. Our chief technology officer, Alan Thompson, is one of the thought leaders in the space around standards and the evolution of them, like Styx and TACSI 2.x, OpenC2, and others. The key point there is that the ability for all of the players in the network and in the industry to communicate and exchange information will be critical to the advancement of security for all. So that's one thing we'll be talking about.
James Carnell and Eric Olson of Looking Glass, thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Cheers.
Stay tuned for more podcasts this week from the RSA conference. Security Ledger is going to be on the ground and covering the show all week. And please join me once again in thanking this week's sponsor, Looking Glass Cyber Solutions. Looking Glass gives you unrivaled visibility into the threat landscape. If you're going to be at the RSA conference in San Francisco, make it a point to stop by and check out their booth, number 100 in the South Hall at Moscone Center.